to Boston, and you've been here ever since.
39 years now. Yeah.
Wow.
39 years.
And so when you came to work at the Mass General, you also began to teach through Harvard Medical School.
Yes.
Could you tell me a bit about what that was like, what being a teacher was like, if you could describe the faculty and the students and your impression of it?
Well, one of the interesting things that I see as a physician and as an educator is the fact that there's a notion by the people who are not in our field that all physicians are educators. That, you know, once you become a physician, you automatically are an educator. And the fact is that we're not trained to be an educator, we're trained to be physicians. It's a service-oriented practice, you know. You're supposed to be a provider of services, you know, to the community. But the teaching aspect is not really, nobody really teaches at Harvard Medical School during those 4 years how to become a teacher or an educator. That you either have the passion for it and develop some skills later after you finish your training, or you just don't do it. There's a lot of physicians, for example, assigned to hospitals who prefer not to do any education, not to teach, even though by being a physician at the MGH, you automatically receive a level of instructor at Harvard Medical School. That's, you know, those two things go together. If you become an educator, then you can continue to be promoted along the echelons of academic promotion. But most of the physicians, you know, decide, no, I'm here to provide service to the community or do research, but I'm not here to do teaching. So it's something that many people expect that you're going to be an educator. I don't know why I enjoy the educational component of it. I probably was probably good in my developing years as a resident, as a student of teaching, but I think I also have to grow and give a lot of honor to my brother, because my brother was a tremendous teacher. But that was his intention. I mean, University of Puerto Rico, you teach. You're not a physician, you teach. But he was such a great teacher, because I remember students of him 10 years after still remembering his teachings. And even now, after many years that he's retired now, there's people still looking up to him as a tremendous educator. That I think that also instilled on me that service part of being an educator. And it probably also come from my mother. You know, my mother always raised us to be to serve without expecting any remuneration, almost to the point of servitude, you know, which is basically what many times we're trained as poor people to do. You just serve, you know, it's like slave, you just serve, you don't expect anything in return. So I was raised in that kind of environment. You just serve. You don't expect anything. If they give you a thank you, that's okay. So I think between my brother, my mother's upbringing, and then the passion, you know, you have to have a passion to do that. Because one of the interesting things is until probably about 7 years ago, 8 years ago, Harvard did not provide any academic promotions pain or educational skills. You know, all was done, how much you publish, how much research you do, and the other things don't count. I told you 17 years serving in the admission committee, that didn't count, that was nowhere to be found. Teaching, getting kudos for the best teacher, for doing this and that, community service, none of those were part of the promotional parameters of medical school until about 8 years ago, and then suddenly they changed, and that's why many people, very good people at Harvard, had to move someplace else, because all what they wanted to do was to teach, but teach was not a way to become promoted at Harvard. And in a sense, that, you know, when I was made professor, I gave a speech, and I said, you know, I did it my way, because I kind of broke the rule, in the sense that I was not a big researcher. I was primarily a provider of care, a good dermatologist, and a good teacher, a good academician. And finally, they started to see the light on the component of being a good teacher. And I was promoted, you know, taking all those things into consideration before Harvard changed their promotional parameters to include teacher activities and community service and things like that. So I did all those things, and luckily in my case, they were accepted in my promotion to become the professor in 88, I think, you know, about 6 years now. But so teaching at Harvard at that point, when I began, was just a passion. You know, you knew that you were not going to be promoted based on spending a lot of time teaching, but it was my passion. I enjoyed doing it, and I think every teacher has some egocentric thinking or narcissist thinking. We need to be a center of attention. If you're a teacher, if you're not a center of attention, so you're not a good teacher. You need to make sure that the people who listen to you believe what you say and are looking up to you for the messages that you transfer to them, the knowledge that you pass on to them, the wisdom or whatever. And so I think each one of us, knowingly or not, I think we do have that center of attention that we like to. And it's funny because in my case, I had always stage fright. I was afraid of being in a group, especially in a large group, talking to a group of people, because I was always afraid that somebody would say, well, what you're saying is not true, or what you're saying is way behind, but you're not up to date in your information. But that was the stimulus for me to become the best teacher I could in terms of learning as much as I could, reading as much as I could. So I would never want to be exposed to somebody, especially Harvard medical students, that challenge you all the time to say, you know, I don't think you said the correct thing. So I became a very good teacher, I think, you know, based on the kudos that I get and all the things, accolades that I get from the medical school and even from the MGH and the Academy of Dermatology, that I think I became a very, very good teacher. But you need that passion, you know. And now, hopefully now, people will stay at Harvard because now they can be promoted based on the teaching skills and the development that they provide to the students. You know, this is an educational institution, you know. It's mind-boggling not to think that teaching is the most important thing, that the promotion to keep people around as faculty members that are good teachers, it makes no sense. But now Harvard has learned to change their environment.
I'm going to almost get ahead of ourselves with
sure.
this, but you pioneered the Hispanic student
mentorship program.
Yeah, the Hispanic student mentorship program. And it just sounds like through your career and through your teaching that the having a mentor and being a mentor is something that is really important to you. And I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about that program. And we'll jump back to the Harvard Medical School stuff, but I think it's right to bring up now.
One of the things that I learned when I was in the subcommittee for the admission process was the struggles that minority students had to get to Harvard, not only to Harvard but to any medical school. Again, that notion that minority students are not as bright as students was still an undercurrent at the medical school and as well as other places. That's why obviously all this minority affirmative action development occurred, because there was definitely discrimination against minorities. And it's true that some minorities don't have the amenities that non-minority students have, in the sense that, you know, for example, in my case, I didn't travel any place. You know, traveling is a way to educate yourself. Communicating with people at high levels is a way that you learn as part of your education. When you're minorities, when you're in that kind of a cocoon environment where you don't expose yourself to any of those things, you have to suffer the consequences of not being exposed and not being educated. And this is why many times minorities are identified as people who don't have the same amenities. And this is primarily because, you know, we come from an environment that is very limited. So one of the things that I learned interviewing minority candidates, specifically Hispanics, how much they had to do, aside from being good students, how much they had to do to work 10 hours, 15 hours, 20 hours a week, and still have to maintain good grades in school, just to keep the family moving. You know, some of these students were the solo winner of income in the family. So they had no time to do anything else. To see that kind of effort of a student to maintain a GPA high enough that will qualify to apply to a medical school like Harvard, and at the same time doing this additional work, even not only additional work, but also volunteering services with the community, because in that community they need a lot of people who can help. So these students were helping community, going to emergency room, serving as interpreter in hospitals and all that. I said, Jesus, I mean, my life was easy, even though I grew up in these limitations as well. But seeing a student, you know, doing all those things, and I said, I need to become an advocate to these students. You know, it just put a light on me that, you know, I was not doing enough just to teach medical learning activities, but, you know, to get involved in these things. And that's when I got more involved. And then some of the Hispanic medical students felt completely disenfranchised. You have to realize that most of the Hispanic medical students come from either Texas or San Francisco or Los Angeles. So they are basically translocated almost across the whole United States to come to a new place in Boston, get used to, you know, the community in Boston, which at the time the Boston community was also very big, and get used to all that. I said, you know, I think we need to develop some kind of program that will support these students. In that process, one of the students that came from California killed herself. She committed suicide during the first 3 months of her entering the medical school at Harvard. And I never knew her well, but I knew a lot of the Hispanic students that were very close to her. And I saw the amount of suffering. I saw a lot of the suffering also by the Dean of Education at that time, who came also from California. So I talked to him, I talked to the students, and I said, I need to develop something. At the time, Bush was the president of the United States, and they had provided some seed money to develop programs for diversity programs. So I applied and for this Hispanic mentorship program, and I made a proposal. It was accepted. The government gave me $100,000 to start the program, and then I organized the program. with the emphasis of the Harvard medical students, Hispanic medical students, but also I included the Hispanic medical students from BU, from UMass, and from Tufts as well. So there were four medical schools involved in that. Harvard was way ahead of being aware of minority issues. The other institutions were not as much. At least Harvard had an office of minority, and ORMA, which is the Office of Recruitment, Minority Recruitment, who Alposant was the director, still is. So at least I knew that Harvard has had a structure for minority students. The other ones were not as structured. So anyways, I developed it at the MGH I was at that time the associate director of the Multicultural Affairs Office of the MGH, and through that, with Elena also, who was the working in that office at that time, we decided to organize the whole thing, and then develop. And it lasted about 9-10 years, and it was very well organized, because I used to interview all the students that participated, interview all the faculty members who were interested. And one of the tenets of this program was that I would prefer to have non-minority faculty being mentors to the minority students, because otherwise we get minorities with minorities and we never really expand the horizons, and the non-minorities will never know that this happened. So most of the mentors were faculties that were non-minority faculty that expressed a feeling that they wanted to contribute. I interviewed them for an hour to make sure that they were committed to that. Elena also did a lot of that. And eventually we got this group together. And we eventually had about 80 students involved through the years in the process. Many of them eventually went on and were successful in their lives, and always thank us for some of the success that they had in their life, because they were exposed. We used to organize seminars by prominent people at Harvard to teach them how they did it and how to do, you know, things to make you progress in the future. And so they were exposed to a lot of prominent people in the process, as well as, you know, the mentors were very close to them for 4 years. So I think it really did an immense, provided an immense opportunity for the medical student, Hispanic medical students, to develop and feel part of the system. The other medical schools in the other institutions were not as good, because there was not a leader in of those institutions, even though some of them did very well as well. I continued to interview them and talk to them, and they used to come and mingle with the Harvard medical students. Eventually, after 10 years, Harvard decided that they wanted to develop their own program. Because, by the way, this $100,000 that the government gave me, they took it away next year. So for the next 9 years, it was the MGA, Peter Slavin, who supported that program for 9 years out of the 10. And he was very committed. With the thinking process of Peter is that if we have those students well educated, they can come to be faculty members at the MGH and improve the diversity movement of the MGH. So, and indeed it happened. So many of those minority Hispanic students eventually came to be faculty member at Harvard, at the MGH. So it really served the purpose that I wanted to do. Eventually Harvard decided, well, we want to do our own. And so they took their the same thing that we had done for the Hispanics, they did it for the whole minority groups, so included, you know, African Americans and Indian Americans. So it really became more of a minority group, but it's ongoing, and it worked out of the ORMA office at Harvard Medical School, and continues to do very well. But the genesis started with that mentorship program of the Hispanic, and it was the first one in the nation. So again, it's part of the pioneering of what we have done here.
And it wasn't, you started it in the 2000s during the Bush administration, so it was relatively
recent. 1999, right.
But you had mentioned, and now we're jumping back, like I said, I went out of order, but
sure.
You had mentioned that your work with the subcommittee for of the admissions committee was something that started to bring these issues to light in your mind.
Right.
So could we talk about the admissions committee, about the admissions process at Harvard, and how you became involved with admissions
sure.
at Harvard
yeah.
Medical School?
Yeah. Well, the historical background, again, was in 65 or 69, whatever, but the affirmative action was established at Harvard. It was basically they decided to bring Al Poussaint as a faculty member to establish, at least give visibility to somebody who's African-American at the medical school and start to see if they can recruit in that process, recruit minority students to the medical school. And then so from there on, they were able to bring minority students to Harvard Medical School, which prior to that, it was non-existent. And then at some point, they decided to do a subcommittee of minority students. And basically, what that entailed was to have a small subcommittee interviewing the minority medical students, which officially were Mexican Americans, African Americans, Puerto Ricans, mainland Puerto Rican, and the American Indians. Those were the four officially considered minorities. So then, that's when at some point I became a member of that committee. Oglesby, I guess he was the dean of education at the time, when he asked me to be a member of it. One of the problems that the committee had was the fact that because that was not important for promotion, nobody wanted to do it. It was a lot of work. So the reason why I stayed for so many years was because I would do it was a 3-year commitment. At the end of the 3 years, you're supposed to get out and they'll name somebody after you to take your place. And there was no other Hispanic faculty member that would be interested in doing this. So the dean of admissions kept on saying, Ernesto, come for a year and just do a year. And then next year will be the same. I tried to recruit myself or the people to replace me because, there was a lot of work. Nobody wanted to do it. It was a lot of work, and there was no academic promotion to go along with it. So I stayed for many, many years. So I got to interview a lot of the applicants in the process. And it was not until the affirmative action was struck down by the Justice Department that finally they had to do away with these committees, so that it would not be looked as people that are minorities were getting some kind of advantage. So not only we would interview and discuss this in these candidates in the subcommittee for, what we also became advocates to the students that we considered good, because then those students will go to the main committee to compete with all the other non-minority groups to compete with them for positions. And so we used to come and present the students at the main committee and defend them to make sure that they had, a fair share. And many of them were accepted. We always didn't want to, Harvard never wanted to talk about quotas, but I remember when this was very active during my time, I remember that we accepted, I think it was 65 minority students out of 165 that are accepted as first year medical students. That was a tremendous gain during that year. But it usually hovered about 47 students out of 165, 50. Most of them obviously were African American, Mexican Americans, a few Puerto Ricans here and there. But I think we really enhanced the possibilities of these minority students, which to us they were excellent students, not only because of their academic status in college, but also because they were doing a lot of the things that Harvard was promoting, which is to be a leader in your community, you know, community service, working in different environments, and also being exposed to a service-oriented practice, you know, which is what physicians are supposed to be oriented to. There were, for example, non-minority students who'd never done anything, you know, other than being students, you know, getting 4-point GPAs, but nothing else. You know, when they came to be interviewed, many of them had no idea that medicine is a service-oriented thing. You're going to be serving the community. I mean, you might do research, you might do other things, but really the impact of what you do as a physician is to serve, is a provider of care. So those minority students had done a lot of that on their own voluntarily. But unfortunately, the medical school was looking mostly for GPAs, for a good exam, you know, the entrance examination and things like that. And many times we'll forget the other components of it. And we were the ones who tried to expose the mayor committees, you know, that these people deserve to be, because they were also leaders, they were also community people, and they needed to be given the opportunity to eventually become physicians and go and serve the community. And there was several publications showing that physicians that had minority physicians will usually go back to their environment. They will go and serve their environment, meaning that they go back to underserved communities as physicians, which many non-minorities will do that. They will usually go to places that will be more economically feasible for them to develop financially. So, you know, that was another thing that proved to Harvard that bringing these minority students is important. And then the pressure from the hospitals. The hospitals start to put pressure on the medical school that we need to be diverse in the hospital. We need to look like the community we serve. So we have a diverse community. We need to develop employees in the hospital, particularly physicians, that will look like the community that we serve. So we want the medical school to train people that are minorities and diverse groups so that they can come to the hospital and serve the community. So that kind of triangle became very important to Harvard, you know. Because the important thing with Harvard is that as an educational institution, they don't have to serve the community. You know, they just basically do what they're supposed to do, educate students and then send them out. The hospital is a business imperative to have diversity. They eventually became acculturated to the fact that there's a lot of other motivations and, for being diversity driven. But the original thing was, you know, how can we bring patients into the hospital? And the way to do it is to provide a community in the hospital that look like the people that we serve.
And at Mass General particularly, you were involved with a multicultural office here, but I think you had also mentioned you were involved with bilingual signs and serving communities that were coming to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. Many years, I don't know how many years now. There was a committee to develop the first floor of the MGH, the entrance of the MGH, which was kind of dark, and people never pay attention to it. You just go through. I'm talking about the White Building, and so there was a committee to redo the area of the entrance of the hospital that would be more appealing to patients coming in. And I was a member of that committee. And one of the things that I proposed was, you know, we need to do bilingual signs. If we're gonna get only non-minorities, non-Hispanic into the hospital, that's one thing. But we are getting people who come in from Chelsea and Revere, places like that, that are Spanish speaking. We need to accept them and make them feel comfortable. We need to develop bilingual signs. The committee was opposed to it. They feel that, you know, they were looking at the money aspect of it. Oh, we're gonna have to spend a lot of money to bring consultants to do all these bilingual signs. And I said, I can do that. I mean, I'll do it for free. I mean, you don't have to. My son, he had worked at Brigham's and Women's with partners. My son has developed, he was the one who designed a lot of the bilingual signs of Brigham's and Women's. You have to remember that Brigham's and Women's is surrounded by a poor community. A lot of them are Hispanic. MGH is not. MGH is basically surrounded mostly by big names, executive people, and non-minorities. So the MGH didn't see the same need that the Brigham's. So I said, you know, I can do the signs. And there was another person that we worked together, and basically we put the signs together, the bilingual signs together. That was probably about, I don't know, 15, 18 years ago. But there was a lot of opposition. One of the things I told him, go to the emergency room of the MGH and see how many Hispanics come through there from Chelsea, Revere, other places. You know, how do they navigate, you know, with no bilingual signs there? And they finally did some statistics, they did, the committee, and they realized there was a lot of Hispanics. I think it was 65% of people coming through the emergency room were Hispanic, and many of them just spoke Spanish. So that gives them some credence to the fact that they needed to do that. And now, you know, it's accepted, and it's like that never happened, that discourse of opposition, because they felt that there was no need for it. That was many years ago.
Oh, but that's just one example of changing attitudes towards serving communities through hospitals, through institutions like MGH or the Brigham. So my official question is, please tell me about your role in developing community connections. Were there other programs at Mass General that you were involved with, or initiatives?
As a member of the multicultural office, I was the associate director. We wanted to bring the hospital back to the community. The hospital was always identified by the community around it, primarily by the poor community, places like Jamaica Plain and other places, Roxbury. They always felt that the MGH was not only too far physically, but also very insensitive to the needs of the communities here, not only because of the language barrier, but because there was hardly any faculty or physicians that would look black or Hispanic. There was no employees that would speak Spanish to accept patients coming through. So we decided, well, we need to bring the community, bring out the hospital to the community and tell the community that the MGH was welcoming everybody. And so there was a lot of plans that never materialized. But one of the things that I had proposed was to have an office at the entrance of the hospital that would talk different languages. So instead of having an interpreter service in the basement of the MGH, we'd bring it to the first floor. So if you speak Khmer, like Cambodians do in Revere, that at least will be an interpreter that will welcome them and tell them, you go there, you go here, navigate the whole process. That never really materialized, but at the same time we did bring, we went out to the community. I became obviously the spokesperson of the hospital for the Hispanic community, you know, mostly in Villa Victoria, which is a Hispanic community right in, on Tremont Street in South End. Also with Jamaica Plain, I used to go and talk to them about the fact that we are changing the environment. But also a lot of the changes happened internally, you know. The bilingual science was the first thing. But then there was a diversity committee that was mandated by the board of trustees of the MGH in 1995-96, as they named the first the president of the MGH, Jim Mongan, who replaced another chief of the hospital. Jim Mongan was given the task of developing a community, a diversity movement at the MGH, which was non-existent prior to 1995-96. So Jim gathered 8 of us, I was a member of that committee, to see what we would wanted to do to improve diversity in the hospital. And it was amazing how much resistance we had from many of the chief of departments, chief of services. They, for one thing, many of them didn't even know what diversity meant. So we have to retrain them. So the committee asked each department and service to bring a plan for diversity of each department or service. And so we spent a whole year, and they would come and make a presentation of what they're planning to do, because there was nothing in place. What they were planning to do to improve diversity in their different departments and services. And that's how the whole thing evolved. And we used to meet 2 hours every other week, 2 hours for a full year, just looking into this aspect, inviting people, inviting experts from outside to tell us how to do things. It was a very intense thing. But Jim Mongan, who was the president, was very committed to make that change. And not only because it was a mandate from the Board of Trustees, but because they believe in it. And so after a year, then we had a plan based on all the things that we heard from the different departments. We had a plan. We asked the Board of Trustees to give us money to support some of the ideas so that they can be carried, because obviously none of the department would like to do it on their own, especially if they had to pay their own money. So the hospital gave us $2 million to start the development of diversity movement. So with that money, based on the ideas that we had generated of 1 year of meetings, then we developed a plan. And the plan was, for example, to bring, offer managerial services to employees that were working primarily in the basement in menial work. Jobs, you know, the, working in the cafeteria, working in maintenance, to offer those people some kind of skills and education that would move them into a man. So basically, the concept back then was that we need to remove the color of the basement and make it to the next level, you know, to bring in people who are black, Hispanic, you know, my color, to bring them to, and we had a recruitment movement to bring faculty, to bring, you know, employees that will represent diversity, and also go out to the community to tell people what we were trying to do. And that's how the whole diversity movement started in 1995, so it's not really too long.
20 years.
Yeah. But we have moved forward very well, you know, through those years, yeah. And Jim Mongan and then Peter Slavin took over, and he continued with the same movement. So he is, I think the MGH has done very well. Now, there's still a lot of things to do. But the important thing is that, you know, I think we changed the culture of the hospital. Now, all these chief of department, chief of faculty, you know, the services, they are now sold on doing this. Now, you don't have to press them to do it. They have plans of their own, you know, and they feel very proud of doing that. So it was a big change, you know, definitely a big change. And I'm very proud to be part of, not proud of the committee, but proud of being an MGH person, you know, because I think they have really tremendous, taken, you know, very seriously this movement of diversity. And I always say that about the MGH is that when the MGH decide to take some activity, you know, to do something, they do it better than anybody else. You know, the reason why they don't do it many times is because they don't believe in it and they don't care about it. But if they decide to take an issue and make it an issue, I think they do it better than anybody else. And if you look at the history of diversity in the hospital, we've been basically first on many of the things that other institutions had begun before, and they have not advanced as fast as the MGH has done in those 20 years. We have, for example, the first center for health disparities and solutions in the country, and that is run by somebody that you should probably venture interview. It's Joe Betancourt, Joseph Betancourt, and he's the first in the country, supported by partners and the MGH. They put $5 million to do that center, and eventually the Wood Johnson Foundation also provided additional money. But that's the first center, and basically what they're doing is when you go to see to a hospital or to a medical facility, what are the services provided to you versus me? You are as a non-minority, me as a minority, and see what disparities in the way that patients are approached because you're different. Yeah. If you go to an emergency room service, for example, the black people receive less pain medication than the white people because they feel that the black people are less sensitive to pain. It doesn't make any sense. But those are notions, probably from slavery, that continues to be a part of the biases of the way that you deal with your population. So, you know, the health disparity is basically looking to all these different things, not only look at them, but also provide solutions.
So I have, I think, maybe three more questions, maybe four.
Okay.
But you've talked a lot about the great things that MGH has done and some of the strides that Harvard Medical School has made. Could you tell me about maybe what they haven't done as well, in your opinion, what you think that they could do better at?
Yeah. Well, I think, by the way, Jeffrey Fly has done a tremendous job since he became the dean. Because I've been involved in this process with three different deans, Dean Tosterson and then Dean Joe Martin, Dr. Martin, and now Flyer. And I think in terms of diversity, he's the most sensitized to it, and the more that he has done to it. But not only in terms of diversity, he also realizes that we have lost a lot of potential good faculty members, excellent educators, people who have done a lot of community service, women that have to deal with the fact that they have a profession and family life. Harvard just kind of dismissed them because they could not publish sufficiently, or they couldn't do this or that. And Fly has changed that significantly. And now I think women feel that they're more comfortable you know, because basically if you're in an academic environment, promotion is the only thing that you get credit for. I mean, if you stay as an instructor for 30 years, then obviously that doesn't speak too well of you or the institution that doesn't recognize what you're doing. So promotion is an important thing, you know. We would not be educators if we don't feel that promotion is part of the message that the medical school provide us to stay. In the hospital is different. The hospital basically, you provide service, you get compensated money-wise for the services that you provide, and then you do other things, committee activities and things like that. But in the hospital, it's money-driven mostly. But the medical school is promotion-driven. So the medical school was never sensitized to it until, you know, it changed, as I told you before. And I think Jeff Fly has done a lot to do that. I've been involved in committees to help promote people who've been as an instructor for 10, 15 years, and they don't have any idea if they will be moving any further. Well, we have a committee now that if you have spent 10 years and you do good teaching, you can be promoted to the next level just by doing the teaching. Before, if you didn't publish, that was it. You stay as an instructor for the rest of your life. So the medical school, I think, needs to continue to move along those lines. And it's not that you will dilute the quality of the people that you, but you do have to recognize a lot of the things that in the old times were not recognized from the academic standpoint, that you have recognized those are values that you offer to the medical school, and the medical school is better recognized by doing things like that. Voluntary service, for example, community service that some of us now do, that was never recognized by Harvard. So I think Harvard has to continue moving along those lines. So you don't necessarily have to be the most proficient in terms of doing research or writing papers or doing the scholarship that the Harvard is always been known for, but you also have to be recognized for these other things. And if Harvard continues to do that, I think it's going to be an institution that will be really a model for the rest. Everybody assumes that Harvard is the best, no question about it. But I think there's still, you know, areas that Harvard can do much better.
Good. And speaking of sort of doing community service, doing that sort of work, I'd like to ask you, you work with the homeless, and you've done that for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that service that you do outside of the hospital as well.
Again, the genesis of it comes from my mother, you know, when she used to tell me that she used to be a homeless person, even though I never really saw it. But then when I was the chief of the clinic, I realized that the homeless that came to be served by the MGH, you know, the Boston Health Community Program, is probably the best program in the whole United States. So Boston has the best homeless community service in the United States. And the way that it works is that the patients go to either dispensaries or shelters or the McGinnis House, which is kind of a specialty hospital for homeless people. And if there's a need for tertiary services, for example, if they need a dermatologist, then they'll have to go to the MGH or to the Boston Medical Center. Those are the tertiary facilities that they have to go to. So when I was the chief of the clinics, a lot of these homeless patients used to be sent to the MGH. I used to see them at the MGH, and I used to see how they suffer at the MGH. Why? Because they didn't look presentable, you know, compared to the people that we serve in the hospital. Some of them are derelicts, but some of them were just economically disenfranchised. Good people, smart people, they just didn't have a home. But because of that, because they didn't look presentable, the patients didn't want to sit next to them, the secretaries didn't want to deal with them, the physicians didn't want to deal with them. And I felt so bad for them, and again remembering what my mother would have experienced if she would be homeless in that setting, I said, you know, I should do something. Jim Mongan, who was the founder of the homeless system in Boston, he was a resident when I was the chief of the clinics. And eventually he was asked if he wanted to develop a homeless program by the chief of medicine here at the MGH. And he did develop it, and at some point he asked me if I wanted to come and see what he had developed. I went, and I knew him and I admired him a lot, because he was a great guy when he was in the training program. So I went to visit the place, and I got enamored with the way that he and his people had developed this program, not only because of the services that they provide, but because the way that it was provided. There was a lot of respect for the homeless people. There was a lot of empathy to the people that they were serving, all the secretaries, all the nurses, all the doctors. I mean, it was a loving experience. You know, I got enamored as soon as I got the interaction that I saw between them. So I wrote a letter to, after that day that I went to see it, I wrote a letter to him. I said, Jim, I would like to go and offer my services for free in dermatology. Just go there and see patients in a clinic, and then advise you what to do with it. I wouldn't even prescribe anything. I just go there and tell you what you prescribe. And he obviously loved the idea. And so that's how it started back in, I don't remember, 1998, 1997, 1999. So I used to go there Fridays and see patients. Interesting, at the beginning, the patients thought that this was all a show. You know, typical, you know, of a defensive thing that they have, because they see a lot of politicians, a lot of people just to say that they do the service and they just appear and then never appear again. That they're always very defensive, the patients there. At the beginning they were. And eventually then, and I remember a case that I always use as an anecdote. It was a patient that I used to see at the MGH when she had a home. She has psoriasis, a disease of the skin. And she was the one who told me this story. I don't remember her. But when I saw her at the homeless shelter, when I went to see her there, she told me, Doctor, I will never go and see you at the MGH because I feel ashamed that I'm now homeless. And I used to go and see you when I had a home and I had economic situation better than I have now. And I said, don't worry, I can see you here every month. Come here and I'll see you. I will do everything here instead of doing that. Then I realized the importance of me going there and provide the service. Because I know that those patients feel so disenfranchised when they come to the MGH. Through Jim Mongan, we sent letters out to invite all the physicians on the hospital to provide similar services, because I was the only specialty service that was provided there. Now they have, I think, psychiatry and other services, but I was the only specialty doctor that used to go to do the services. And about 20 doctors, you know, offer their names to go, you know, voluntarily to offer their service, but it was never really organized too well. So I continued to do it. And about 4 years ago, there was one of our residents who had very similar demeanor to me, Jen, and she started to come with me to the clinics and got enamored with the whole concept as well. So when she finished, she decided to write a proposal to my department about the fact that she wanted to develop a dermatology service there that would be enhanced beyond what I had been offering, but also that could be could serve as an educational tool, so that our residents in dermatology will spend time with her and me, and develop some empathy for seeing these poor people there. And so we developed that about 4 years ago. Now it's mandatory for all our residents to go and spend time in the homeless shelter, seeing patients with her or me, providing the service. And they love it. They enjoy that experience. I also loved it because I didn't have to deal with the insurance companies. It was voluntary service, so I didn't have to charge the patients. If I need to spend half an hour talking to a patient because the patient needed that interaction, I would spend half an hour in the hospital. If I go beyond 10, 15 minutes, the insurance will say, well, you're not efficient. We don't want you, you know, too. So it was an oasis for me to provide the services the way I wanted to provide the services with no limitations attached to it. But also because the environment there is so respectful, the dignity of the people are so important to everybody that serves there, that I love to go there. Unfortunately, I got sick. I got a kidney transplant. I'm not allowed to go there because I'm not supposed to be exposed to people that I could get infections with. But Jen continues to go there, and now we have another faculty member that goes there. We have residents that rotate through there, so they all know about homelessness, about empathy, you know, about the service that we need to be aware of the fact that, you know, this is what physicians is all about, is to provide service. And the problem is that most of the physicians do it for money. Not necessarily that all physicians like to do it that way, but, you know, you get well compensated for it. There's no doctors that is destitute. And the problem is that we need to be aware of the fact that we should dedicate some time to say, okay, I'll do this service to the community without expecting any compensation, but just the satisfaction of providing the service. And that's the concept. That's what I like to propose to the people, you know, physicians and other people. And I think this goes back to the minority students at Harvard. Many of them go to provide that kind of service to the minorities, communities that they were raised, because they have that connection. And if more of us feel that same urge or need to satisfy ourselves by providing this service for free to people who are underserved and needed, I think we will have a much better society. So I'll continue to do that, even though I'm kind of distant, but I'm still identified as a person. And then I have a patient of mine who's a tremendous benefactor to this hospital and to other activities, who I invited with Jim to go and see the homeless operation. He got enamored too. So now he gives a certain amount of money every year of my name, so that we can continue to expand the dermatology service there. So with that now, we don't depend as much of the MGA service, neither of the Boston Medical Center, because we can do procedures there. We can do a lot of things that we could not do before, because now we have the money to buy equipment and supplies provided by this benefactor. So it turned out to be an excellent thing. By the way, there's a pathologist when we do biopsies to read the biopsies for free. And that's his contribution to the homeless population. Normally those biopsies would cost about $300, you know. So he does his biopsies for free, and the homeless don't have to pay for that. So it's very satisfying for me, you know, to do that. And again, it's in memory of my mother, you know, not only because she suffered that, but because that's what she wanted me to do, to serve the community, not expect any money in return. Obviously, you have to live your life, you know, so you need some income. But it's always, you know, weekends, instead of spending 2 hours on watching TV or playing golf or whatever, you could use that time to do that. And I think it will be much more satisfying. If many, many physicians, I'm sure that would love to do that. Many times what happens is that they are not exposed to it. They don't know how to start doing things like that. And this is why we have the residents going there, because at least they're exposed to it. And if they like it, they might continue to do that once they finish. So hopefully that would be the message and the intent.
That's wonderful. That's all of it. It's really wonderful. The next question I had for you was a question about legacy, but I can already see and hear from the stories that you've told and the changes that you've made at Mass General and at Harvard Medical School and your work with the homeless that you've done a lot of very important things in your career that have far-reaching effects. And I'm curious about the Ernesto Gonzalez Award for Outstanding Service to the Latino Community, if you wouldn't mind talking about that. But just to,
I guess that was a decision made by the hospital, you know, the president of the hospital, I think it was Peter Slavin or Jim Mongan. It's a Hispanic month that is now celebrated. It's in September to October. And for many years, it was kind of, nobody knew about it, and institutions were not really doing anything specific about that celebration. But slowly, you know, as this diversity movement developed, then they started to pay more attention to it. And I remember during the early years, well, I was kind of the spokesperson for the whole thing, because I was the only faculty at a high level that was Hispanic. There was not too many Hispanic.